Well, we may as well get started. Thank you for joining us today, this Friday, to talk about safety. It's my pleasure to introduce Matt Stinchfield. Matt has been actively creating safer workplaces for more than three decades, focusing on brewery safety for the last 18 years. He is a safety consultant to mid-size and regional craft breweries and distilleries, in addition to founding his own brewery in Lincoln, Nebraska in 2014. He is currently co-chair of the Brewers Association Safety Subcommittee. As safety ambassador for the BA, Matt travels nationwide educating brewers on ways to improve brewery safety through conscientious and affordable strategies. Please welcome me in welcoming Matt Stinchfield.
Thanks, Damon.
Okay, this is going to be lively. Shake it off a little bit, kind of safety meeting vibe here. And I'm really, really happy to talk today because we're going to break down one of the sort of basic steps. I call this putting your foot in the pool. You know, I know you all want to be safe. Sometimes it's overwhelming to think about how do I get started? How do I first put my foot in the pool? I want to learn to swim, but I'm just afraid of the deep end. And so I'm not going to mention OSHA today at all, except to say I'm not going to mention them. Okay? We're going to talk more about a very, very critical but pretty straightforward, simple process that is going to assure that you can achieve the number one goal in safety, which is to create and sustain a safe workplace for you and your coworkers, okay, free of obvious hazards. Well, how do we do that? Okay, we look at a task, we break it down step by step, just like you're writing an SOP, and then we take it one step further and we look at each of those tasks and say, what could go wrong right here? What could hurt me? What could damage equipment? What could cause a problem for the next person to come along? And that's a hazard, okay? Once we know what that hazard or hazards are at that step of the task, then we look to come up with a solution, or quite often many solutions that we operate simultaneously, okay? Just like in a car, you've got an airbag, a seatbelt, traffic signs that are helping you, the training, hopefully, that you remembered in learning how to drive a car, and your caution in dealing with other cars on the road. All of those things together give you automotive safety. And just like that, in the brewery, all of those different techniques we call hazard control strategies, you can bring them to play for a particular hazard at a particular moment in a task that you're doing. Once you try this out, I promise you, number one, it will feel good. You will feel a sense of accomplishment and like, okay, I think I'm getting it, the light will come on, and then you're going to take it to the next task and do the same thing. Some are going to be real easy, some are going to have more detail. And so what I want to do today, in less than an hour, and I'll try to even get you out early, which is hard for me because I go on like a Baptist preacher about safety, but I will try to break it down for you. We'll go through a simple example that all of you in a brewery are familiar with, and we're going to see how that breaks down. But in order to get there, I want to first know what hazard assessment is. It's understanding the hazards of the task so you can do two really awesome things. One is implement those hazard controls, because if you haven't identified the hazard, you know, there's no sense in wearing ear protection in a nice quiet area. Okay? So, you know, find what the hazard is and then come up with a good group of hazard controls. But the best part of it is you avoid accident and injury and you go home in at least as good a shape as you arrived at work in the morning. That's what it's all about. That's the hokey pokey right there, folks, is just trying to get home in one good piece. I want to start by just outlining five important terms that I'm going to use again and again in the discussion here, and I'll throw in a few more as we go on, but here they are. First of all, incident and accident. In safety parlance, an incident is not anything bad that has happened. It's something bad that could happen. You might call it a near miss. It's an opportunity for a problem, okay, for something bad to happen, for a hazard to occur, okay? There's an electrical outlet that's kind of missing its faceplate, and you're plugging a 220 plug into it, okay? That's an incident. That's an opportunity for the hazard to manifest itself and electrocute you, which we call an accident, okay? So incidents happen all around. accidents happen once in a while. The more incidents you have, the greater your chance for an accident. And the name of safety is reducing incidents. We want to take away the opportunity for things to go bad, and therefore they can't go bad. And in this way, safety has a sort of a Zen component. If we can just, like, sometimes the most elegant safety strategy, the most elegant hazard control, is something that is so simple and requires no equipment. It's just like a common sense thing. But I'm reminded of Voltaire, the French philosopher, who said, you know, common sense is altogether uncommon. Okay, I know we have it in us to be commonsensical, and some of the best stuff is going to come from that. Some of it's going to come from equipment. We'll see how that goes. Okay, those hazard control strategies, and I'm going to list out four of them later on here, fall into two categories, prevention and protection. The prevention ones are the best because we avoid the hazard from existing. We eliminate the hazard from its own possibilities, at least in regards to the hazard and us. And then there are protective strategies where the hazard coexists with us in the workplace and we keep it from affecting us in a hazardous way. Okay? We're working with caustic, we're working with acid, we're working with oxidizing sanitizers. That goes with the territory. We're not going to be able to completely prevent their use. So we resort to protective strategies. We use the right pump. We use containers that can handle it. We have secondary containment in case a little spills while we're doing something, or in case a container fractures because somebody bumps it with a forklift or is sitting in the sun too long or who knows what. We think about what could go wrong and we use equipment. In the case of protective strategies, we use equipment to keep our well-being around the hazards. Driving a car is hazardous. There are hazards all over the place when we're out on the road, and cars are filled with protective devices because we can't stop all of the accidents from happening. Because frankly, even if you were awesome, the most awesome driver ever, the guy beside you is not, right? So that's why we have both prevention and protection strategies. And then hazard assessment, what we're focusing on today, first identify hazards that are associated with the job at hand, and then propose protective and preventative strategies, usually a bunch of things at once, because we want redundancy here. Okay, first step in hazard assessment doesn't really have anything to do with hazards. But we're gonna talk about them first so that when we get to that point, we'll know what we're talking about. This diamond, this placard, is something that the Brewery Safety Subcommittee, which I'm a member of, came up with, and it's got really nice little simple icons on here that talk about most of the kinds of hazards that you're going to run into in a brewing situation. From the upper left kind of zigzagging across, electrical hazards, pressure hazards, temperature hazards. That's hot and cold. Do you know you can get frostbite from fast-releasing compressed gas fittings? You can get burned, obviously. Slips and falls, it says here. We have an old saying in safety, slips and trips often lead to falls. Okay. Now, a slip or a trip can injure you just by trying to auto-correct and jack something in your body. But the falls can be much, much worse. So I refer to things as slips, trips in today's slideshow just for brevity. But understand that we're really talking about slips and trips and falls there. Ergonomic things, lifting. Keg weighs, half barrel weighs 160, 165 pounds. Don't be lifting that by yourself. Are you going to get to be in your 50s like me and go, homie, don't play that? Because I couldn't if I wanted to, and I don't want to. So mechanical lifting and buddy lifting. Ladders, elevated workplaces in general, whether they're fixed or mobile. Flammable compounds here. We've got reactive oxidizers in the brewery for sanitizing, for example. We've got confined spaces, a couple of different kinds of confined spaces. Those that we could find a good procedure for getting into when we need to, and those that we should not ever, ever, ever go into unless we're very well equipped, highly trained, have an emergency response group standing by, monitoring devices, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, some confined spaces like cleaning, you know, final cleanup in your mash tun, that can be done when you achieve certain mechanical and fixture controls called lockout, tagout, entering a fermenter, don't do it. Forklift safety, hearing conservation, sharps, you know, not just broken glass. You don't have to have a bottling line to have sharps, because you all have box cutters and you're opening sacks of grain and cartons of hops, and, you know, you set that thing down with the blade open and you grab it. You'll do it to yourself if you haven't already. Mechanical hazards that come from, you know, conveyor lines and mills and so forth. And then acids and bases, oxidizing chemicals, and sometimes even some poison. So these are the kinds of hazards that we're going to be thinking about. You don't have to know the hazard in great detail to say, when I pump caustic out of a barrel, if it gets on me, that's a bad thing. And then, you know, we're going to dig one level deeper and find out what are those bad things and how do we keep it from affecting us. And then we'll have answered the question that we're trying to answer, which is, what kind of hazard control strategy works for caustic? But first, let's define safety. And I usually go through this in a lot more slides, and it's a big, long process, and it breaks down. I'm going to just show you the answer that we come up with. Safety, this is the most lean definition I know of for safety, and I just love it. Safety is freedom, because freedom's a good thing, right? So let's put this on the positive. Safety is freedom from accidents and incidents. Great. Safety is the condition in which we are at work or at home or at play where we don't have the opportunity for hazards to get us, and therefore hazards don't get us because we don't let them exist to the extent that we can, or to the extent that they do exist, we've protected ourselves from them. It's a very nice place to be. And we've been over this. I want to go over it again. Hazard assessment, it's the fundamental tool here in all of your safety programs. So if you've looked at, I looked into those safety regs a little bit, and I found out, you know, there's a confined space program and lockout, tagout, and personal protective equipment, and oh my gosh, do we have to all be going to a occupational clinic before we wear a respirator? Am I going to have to shave my beard? You know, all this stuff. Let's just take one thing at a time and just go break it down by the task and come up with a good way to do it, a safe way to do it. That's what we're doing today. All right, so we've outlined quickly just some of the hazards we could encounter in a brewery in a very general sense, and now we're going to look at some of those control strategies. This is my little drawing that I use, my little Da Vinci brewer, unisex brewer in the middle here, okay? The BA didn't want me to have a naked person. And South Carolina wouldn't let me show both sex parts. So, North Carolina, pardon me. So, sorry about that if you're from South Carolina. At any rate, look, I've put four orbits around this brewery worker here. Personal protective equipment, we call it PPE. That's the innermost thing that I can talk about. If we're only relying on PPE to protect ourselves from what? From a hazard, okay? If we're only relying on PPE to protect ourselves from a hazard, and that PPE fails, news to the world, PPE fails, we make the wrong choice in selecting it. It wears out, it gets torn, it gets cracked, it gets the contaminant on the inside of the PPE the next time we put it on. I mean, all kinds of things go wrong with PPE. It's prone to fail. If that's the only thing that we've got and it fails, we get exposed. All right, so that's obviously not good enough. Yes, it's the most fashionable part of safety, but it's not the most effective. In fact, it's the least effective. I'm going to work out in an order here that's a little different than the four-letter word guys that I said I would never mention again, because they rate engineering controls as being a really superior form of safety. And I don't, and I'll tell you right now why. Because it requires you to buy stuff, and you have to make the right decision in buying it to get the right stuff. It can be expensive. The things on the outside here, the first line of defenses for you, administrative controls and safe work practices, by my definitions, don't cost you very much at all. Okay? They require a little effort, and they require you to think. Okay? I think OSHA I think those four-letter word guys like engineering controls because it took something away from the responsibility of the employee. It said, put more emphasis on the employer to create a safe workplace for the employee. Look, I know how breweries get started. I know how they're working. You're doing a lot. By yourself. You're inventing stuff to solve problems that you encounter. Okay? That's not an engineering control usually. That's not something you should be just making as you go. Okay? But you can write your own plan in an administrative control. You can print your own sign as an administrative control. And you can operate with good, safe work consciousness and safe work practices, and you can do that with no special equipment. You don't even need a color printer. It's just the stuff in your head. There's a puddle on the floor. I choose not to step in it. I don't know what it is. That's like gold star safety right there. That's the beginning, because you recognize there's a potential and you avoided it. Now, you don't just leave it there. We're gonna chase that one down the rabbit hole until it's resolved. But at first blush, that is a safe work practice. It's a divine safe work practice. If you know that carbon dioxide accumulates in low spaces and you have your cold room for your kegs of beer and your tap room are in a cellar, and your CO2 tanks are in a cellar, then you know there's a possibility for CO2 to accumulate down there, and you can be walking around upstairs just fine and walk down into that cellar and asphyxiate, not be able to turn around and come back and die in your steps. It happened last year to a lady in a bar here on the East Coast. Okay, so avoiding is the best. And in the absence of avoiding, we have to protect ourselves. So here's an example of protection. Here's a hazard that we're going to have that hazard in the workplace because it's a hazardous chemical. We're going to protect ourselves with the appropriate personal protective equipment, and it's going to be well-selected, well-maintained, constantly inspected, and retired as soon as there's any problem with it. And we're able to deflect that hazard off of our PPE. Great stuff. Love it when it works that way. But that's as if we only had this one layer of protection. But if we allow ourselves to have all these layers of protection and prevention, then when we encounter a hazard that we don't even know about, or that's, let's say, a little bit more random, a wild hazard, okay? Something that's out of the norm of experience, we start with caution. That's a brilliant safe work practice. I don't know what's going on over there, but it doesn't smell right. Okay? That doesn't mean get closer, because it's not going to smell any righter as you get closer. All right? So that's the beauty of prevention. And oftentimes we can't achieve prevention, so we have to use protection. And I'll get awkward for you for just a second and talk about safe sex. Okay? If the hazards for you and in relation to sex were unwanted pregnancy and a disease, the best way to not encounter those two hazards are to not participate in sex. Abstinence, right? That's total prevention right there. Now that leaves most people like they're not doing their job. Okay? They're not living life to the fullest. They're not doing what they really want to do. So they go, I'll be selective. That's a kind of prevention. I won't do certain things that would promote the transmission of disease more than another. I will talk to my partner, as awkward as this sounds, to make sure that I'm not going to give them anything and they're not going to give me anything. I'll make sure I understand their religion so I know if contraception is okay. And then I'm going to use a combination of, I call it safe work practices, but safe sex practices and personal protective equipment. And then when I get all that configured, I go, all right, now we can party. And they go, like, kind of killed the mood there, Matt. But look, if I can stand up here and talk to you about safe sex, I want you to be able to talk to your coworkers about safety, because it's a hell of a lot easier than talking about safe sex. Okay? It's very awkward, as you can tell. And I practice talking about safe sex. I mean, for you guys, not because, I'm on Match.com. All right, so I'm going to break down these four layers. We're going to start at the outer part of the circle, work inwards towards you, the worker, and we're going to start with safe work practices. There's nothing special I can show you here, other than my Jerry Lewis guy. It's because they're common sense things. No special equipment required, most preventative. It's like it's safety as a philosophy. That's what we are here, okay? Next down the line, administrative controls. These are those things that are written signs, posters, banners, alarms, emergency phones, all that sort of thing, training programs especially. Those written things have a lot of good content in them, but there is a couple of problems. One, do they exist for you? Do you have a written confined space program at your brewery? Few do. Most need one, if not all of you. You know, if you don't have this thing written yet, well, all of a sudden you're missing that layer of prevention. You've got the knowledge, the safe work practice knowledge, I don't want to go into confined space, but that's about all I know. Okay, well, if that's all you know, it could still keep you out of trouble. Engineering controls. Now we're getting down into protective stuff. I like to think about engineering controls as systems that manipulate a hazard, you know, arm's length or further away. Okay, they could be as simple as railings or berms in an area where you have your CIP chemicals, so that if they spill, they don't run out over the whole floor. Simple engineering control. A secondary containment pallet that you set your chemical corrosives on. I'm going to show you two slides to kind of break down a couple of examples here. Controlling power is one of the things that we do here in the workplace. We're controlling loose electrical power, mechanical power, mash rakes, for example, chemical power from reactive acids, bases, and oxidizers, and thermal energy. And we usually do this kind of controlling with these little devices here called lockout, tagout supplies. All right, so this is a way of turning off a switch, locking it, putting the one key to that lock in your pocket, and then going to work on that circuit. Nobody can turn that circuit on and energize it while you're working on it, because you alone have the key, and you're the one working on the system. Now, that's beautiful. Don't you love that? It's so simple. It's just a padlock with one key. On the other hand, how many of you work in a packaging line where you're sticking your hand into some rotating filler head to pick out that broken bit of glass or the cap that went missing? Okay, see the difference? You know, I know you want to package the beer, but wouldn't you like to have two hands? So, you know, at that point you go, no, power off, lockout, ba-dum. Or maybe you have a balsa wood ruler that you just stick in there, and if it gets caught up, it's not going to be, you know, it's going to be lost, but not your hand. I'm not saying that's the right way. Each of you can find out what your own engineering controls are, but that's an example. And also, very important for controlling pressure in the brewery, especially those of you who've come up from home brewing and nano routes, you're working with something quite a bit different than you're used to. We're talking about stainless steel vessels that are not designed to hold more than one atmosphere above the atmosphere. So we call that one PSI, one atmosphere gauge, or 15 PSI gauge. That's, you've already got one atmosphere around. The contents of the tank can have one atmosphere more on it, and then that's it. That's the max for those tanks. You need to have, right here, you know, if you don't know that this is a PRV, pressure relief valve, that goes on the, excuse me, back up now, Sparky. Those go on the, you know, can go on the dome of the tank or on the CIP arm. Secondary regulators, cylinder restraints, all those kind of things that go with the control of the hazardous pressures in a brewery. Okay, so some of those are not too expensive. I got it. That's cool. I didn't show you all sorts of fancy, you know, man lift systems and so forth. Personal protective equipment. Now we're down to that innermost layer where, like this astronaut, he's sweating. He's a little bit nervous. And you should be too, because, you know, if his suit fails, he gets sucked out into a you know, cosmic void. And if your PPE fails, you could end up with, you know, disfiguring burns on your skin. You could lose an eye, or it could even be fatal. So remember that PPE is not fail-safe. And when it does fail, not if it fails, but when it does fail, you're next. Great old ad in the safety tabloids used to have a hand made out of a sponge. It was a ad for gloves. It said, to most chemicals, your hand looks like this. Looks like a sponge. Okay? So we're made for an aqueous environment, not an aqueous environment at pH of 14 or pH of 3 or 2 like that. All right? So keep that in mind. The very most important thing I can say about personal protective equipment is regarding its selection, its use, cleaning, and its inspection and replacement. I'm going to show you about a half a dozen slides right now that focus on some different personal protective equipment. I don't want to feel like I'm making the decision for you, but I want to give you a place to start when you're looking for what kind of safety equipment should I have in my PPE inventory. If you're going to spend the money, at least start with some good stuff here. Three kinds of eye protection that you want to see in your brewery. First off, just a nice pair of all, you know, good visibility safety glasses with side shields, And by the way, these are imprinted with the Brewers Association on the temple. They're really cute. There's some on the back table for you at the end of the talk, and they're for free. Take one home for yourself and one for a coworker. George Mackey right here from Dogfish Head. This was his idea a few years ago, and the BA copied it. So thanks a lot, George. These are great. Take them wherever you go, because the brewery tour you go on next may not have anything for you to use. But in regards to chemical splashes, you've got to have some goggles that could take a splash. And any of you who pumped out caustics or acids out of a barrel or a five-gallon jug know that there are these drops that fly off and they land on the wall and they discolor the paint or the steel rack that they're on and things like that. And so, you know, maybe you didn't see it, but then you look around and you go, hey, what's all that? Well, that's corrosivity caused by these chemicals. So if that can happen, imagine what it'll do to your eyes. And then invest in about $6, the blue one on the right here, $6 on Amazon. I won't say a vendor. You can certainly find a flip-down face shield like that. And every time you're handling concentrated cleaning chemicals in the brewery, you should just wear that. And wear it. You know if you're successful in this? You go to the men's room and you look in the mirror and you realize you're still wearing it. Now, I don't know what you expect to touch with those gloves on, but at least you've got, you know, you've begun to enculturate yourself and habituate yourself into the use of some good safety equipment, and I don't find that a problem. It's a much bigger problem not to have it available for use. Gloves, four kinds of gloves here that are really useful in a brewery. Number one, some nitrile, the thin, stretchy nitriles that come 100 to a box for light hazard use. So sanitizers at working solution strength, something like that. And then on the lower right, the heavy green nitriles, which are, 14, 16 mil thick, big clunky things. They're a little bit hard to operate a tri-clamp with, but you'll get used to it. Those for concentrated acids and bases, and they'll give you a little protection from hot surfaces. There are insulated gloves that have a neoprene dip on them, and those are nice if you're working in a cold room a lot, doing packaging or shuffling kegs or things. They've got good grip on them. They'll give you a little thermal protection until the back of the glove gets wet, and then it's no good anymore. And then the sort of latex living gloves, if you remember those, for dishwashing, the yellow latex underneath with a neoprene dip on the outside. Those are also very good gloves. They're a little bit stretched to fit, so if you find the right size, you can find you've got a lot of dexterity with those, better than the green ones. So those are my short-term recommendations right there, not knowing specifically what you might be working with. For foot protection, certainly you're going to want to have some chemical protective footwear. And here's the thing on chemical boots. If you look up glove manufacturers, you'll find dozens of different compounds. Nitrile, Viton, Mylar, PVC, PVA, blah, 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 right? When you go, you find boots and they're made of PVC, no matter what. Well, PVC is not the best chemical safety membrane for all hazards. But chemical boots are made about a half an inch thick with cheap PVC. So that's the trade-off, okay? For $20, you get a pair of boots that has a steel toe and a steel shank in it. And, after 6 months, it gets a little fatigued and gets a crack, and you pitch them and get another pair. Good investment for your feet. They also are now making some little shorter ones that just come up to the ankle. That might work for you, too. I always give a recommendation here. Try to get the pant leg. Use wide-legged pants and put the pant leg over the boot, which give you a little more splash protection if you get hit with something like hot wort. And then you might have, in other parts of your operation, you might have other kinds of safety shoes that would include, more office-y looking or, out for sales or delivery routes, the sneaker-looking ones there. And don't forget an apron. Again, chemical protective material, usually a very thick PVC. They're cheap, really just a couple of bucks. They'll last for a while, and then you replace them. Fall harnesses. I'd love to see more of the fall harnesses and anchor. Three things here. The harness itself, the connection between you and the anchor, we call the lanyard, and the anchor system itself. All three of those things I want to see more of in breweries, especially for people who are dry hopping through the tops of tanks. Find a way to affix something that's solid anchor to your ceiling and actually clip in like you're rock climbing when you get up there. It would make me feel a lot better. And, a 20-foot tumble and coming down on, something like a piece of stainless steel pipe sticking out of a sanitizing bucket would, ugly. So, and hearing protection, you know, your choice, your employer's choice about whether disposable, reusable, combination of two in cases of great noise, when to wear them, what parts of the operation, under what manufacturing conditions, you know. And with as with respirators, which I'm going to show you on the next page, but not talk very much about, with hearing protection and respirators, there's a cut point. Above a certain exposure level, you need to have a program, and you need to be fitted and all this good stuff. And below that exposure level, you may voluntarily wear hearing protection or a respirator. And that level is a measurement that's made by a scientist called an industrial hygienist. And they're a special kind of sampling technician and scientist. You can sometimes get your insurance company to send one out for you for free to help you decide what that cut point is. But in the interest of time, I'm going to move on here to our example. Okay. I picked a job that is very routine. It happens in every brewery. It's the caustic washing of a vessel. And I'm going to ask you, I made certain simplifications here. For example, there's not a pre-rinse being discussed. Simplifications just so that we can get down to the nitty-gritty. And I understand that your procedures in your brewery may be a little bit different. You may have fixed CIP plumbing and so forth. This is all done with a portable system. You may not have CIP tank. You may be loaded into the vessel manually, dilute it, you know, and then recirculate it with a portable pump. So just take that into consideration. We're going to start by looking very simply at the very simple 30,000-foot level of the job. From the left, we're going to set up a CIP machine. The way I'm going to do it is I'm going to put warm water rinse in the left tank, and I'm going to put hot caustic solution at 2% caustic in the right tank. And then I'm going to get my caustic from this pile of chemicals over here. And then once I've made up my solution, I'm going to connect the CIP machine to the tank that I'm cleaning, and I'm going to clean it and then rinse it with warm water. Capiche? We got the task, right? Very simple task. If I outline that into simple steps, this is what I've got. I've got to connect the plumbing. I've got to fill the tanks, including making up the caustic. I load the caustic into the tank. I recirculate the caustic in the tank. Then I drain the caustic from the tank. And in this jurisdiction, that 2% caustic can go down the drain. Your mileage may vary, depending on your local wastewater authority. Then I'm going to reset the valves, and I'm going to load warm water for the rinse in, and I'm going to recirculate that warm water rinse, and then I'm going to drain that out. And then I'm going to open everything up, hang up the hoses, take off the fittings, open up the manway, and let it dry out. That's the job. Okay? I haven't showed you any people in this job yet because I don't want to sway you in any way. We're just looking at the job. We're not, see, I haven't mentioned any hazards, have I? I mean, I said the word caustic, but I didn't say what caustic is hazardous for. So I'm just outlining the job. Now I'm going to break it down in more detail. It's going to get ugly. We're going to come out of the mud, and it's going to be simple again. And in the end, we're going to have this elegant understanding of how we're going to do the job, not just these procedures, but integrate safety as we go. We're doing a hazard assessment right now. My first step, connect the CIP to the vessel. Then I break it down very, very detailed. I connect the pump inlet to the pump, bottom drain on the vessel. The pump outlet to the CIP arm on the vessel. Crack the manway open, do-do-do-do-do. Open the sample valve if there is one. And then I close or blank all the other flanges, and I plug in the CIP pump. Right? And that's what it becomes. These jobs become that way for us. Because maybe we're doing it at 4:30 in the morning, too. And, you know, ba-dum. I'm not going to take you all the way through all nine steps here, but I'm going to get to the caustic part here. I fill the CIP with caustic and rinse. I'm adding warm water to the left tank up to the overfill tube. On my system, it's 73 gallons. I add hot water to the right tank up to the overfill tube. And while the hot water is adding, I add caustic. Still haven't really talked about hazard control yet. Now I've got warm water and hot caustic. And I've already hooked my hoses up. Now I have to open the valves in the right way, the caustic tank pump valve to the pump so that I can take caustic from the tank and admit it to the pump head. And the outside, the outlet of the pump is already hooked up to the CIP spray arm. Then I open that valve. I turn on the pump and dispense caustic contents into the vessel. Boom, Pump's done. It's all in. Turn off the pump. Next one. I have to reconfigure now. So I open the valve on the bottom of the vessel so that the caustic will come back to the pump. I close the CIP tank so that it doesn't all run into the CIP tank. And now I'm getting my supply to the pump from the bottom of the tank. Caustic's coming back from the tank into the pump, back up the CIP spray arm, and I run the dishwasher cycle for 20 minutes. And then I turn off the pump. And then I have to fiddle with the valves again, and I have to do this part carefully because I'm going to take off a hose off the pump head of the pump that just had caustic in it, hot caustic, 180 degrees, and I'm going to put it in the floor drain, which you might have noticed I had strategically placed my CIP machine right behind the floor drain so that I could take that hose off and go right to the drain. If nothing else, that's just a safe work practice. I know the behavior because of my experience. I know that this hot caustic liquid is going to want to spray out of that. So I've closed the valve that's supplying it, so there's only a gallon in the hose. And then I crack that tri-clamp, stay way away, drop it into the floor drain. I load the vessel with rinse by going back to step three again, do the valves the way I had them for step three. I load the warm water rinse in, reconfigure the valves for step seven like I had in step five, blast my rinse water through, run that for 10 minutes, turn the pump off, send the rinse to drain. And at the end of that process, 8.4 here, I drain the CIP tanks, rinse everything out, disconnect all the hoses and fittings, allow everything to air dry. That's my task as I understand it. And now let's look at the hazards that come with it. So this is very detailed, right? But you know what I've just done, whether I knew it or not? I just wrote the skeleton of my SOP for tank cleaning. So we're going to kill two great birds with one stone. We're going to have an excellent SOP, but once we add the hazard control stuff, it's going to be brilliant because it's going to say what we do at each step of the way to avoid encountering a problem. So let's find out what those problems are. So here are my 8 steps, and I've just simplified the title here. And then I've come up with essentially 5 different types of hazards that I could encounter. And in the first one, I've got hoses and cords hanging around on the floor space. I could slip and trip. I've got a 220-volt power cord I've got to plug into an outlet. And I'm not maybe in a wet environment now, but I shortly will be. I'm going to fill the tanks. I've still got the hoses and my water supply hose and my brewery hoses there and my electrical cord. And now I'm working with very hot water. If I can't dispense 108 in my brewery, I'm dispensing 140-degree water, and I'm heating it up with a coil that's in the CIP tank, now up to 180. And I'm dealing with this alkaline corrosive, which is my caustic cleaner. And I'm differentiating. I said I had 5. Did anybody catch that? I have 5 hazards, and you're looking, you say, I only see these 4. The reason I said 5 is because in step 2, I'm dealing with concentrated corrosive. In steps 3, 4, and 5, I'm dealing with working strength corrosive. I've diluted it down to 2%. It's still not very good stuff at 2%. I mean, that's why we use it. Powerful cleaner. So there's corrosive here at full strength. And then I'm going to encounter the same hazards when I load the caustic into the tank, when I recirculate it into the tank. It's going to splash out the manway, right? I want to get all the little nooks and crannies. So I've cracked the manway, and some caustic is coming out there onto the floor. It's coming out the sample port valve and dripping onto whatever's down below that. So now there's caustic sort of uncontrolled on the floor. And then I'm going to load the rinse. And again, you know what I said as I simplified here, while I'm actually got the rinse cycle going, I'm taking the garden hose and I'm cleaning all that caustic to the floor drain so that I can reduce my level of personal protective equipment. It's really no fun being in all that gear. And then slips and trips the rest of the way. So this is where it gets simple. See, got this sort of very detailed little step-by-step procedure. And we go, these are the hazards that I'm running into at each point. And now I'm going to take you through the meat and the potatoes here, or, you know, the tofu and the carrots for vegetarians. Take you through those 5 hazards. So first, let's look at slips and trips. And these are going to be slips and trips that could occur at any time during the job. I've made 2 columns here, safe work practices and administrative controls I've called prevention, and engineering controls and PPE I've called protection. And yes, you could probably come up with different ones that work for you. This is what I had. as far as safe work practices, don't walk in puddles. Why? Because those puddles might well contain caustic, and they're slippery. Caustic is by nature slippery. Keep my eyes on the floor, right? I could step in a floor drain, I could trip on a hose, I could put my foot in a bucket of sanitizer, I could kick the bucket, you know, all sorts of problems there. And avoid, it goes without saying, avoid distractions. This is not the time to be trying to give people a tour of the brewery, right? Walk like a duck to lower the center of gravity. You know this one? I know it looks funny, but have you ever found yourself doing this? What you know, you're bending at the knees, your toes are out, and you lowered your hip height. This is a very safe position to walk in wet or mixed texture surfaces. So, you know, it's okay. Nobody's going to make fun of you if you do that. Really. I mean, I won't. I'll praise you. Organize your hoses and cords with the aisles. You'll see further on in pictures here. I spent 30 years doing hazardous waste emergency response, going into really, really gnarly confined spaces where we had ventilation systems, monitoring systems, fresh air systems, multiple different hoses, tools, bucket ropes for bringing stuff in and out, okay? A manhole starts to look like a surgical field you've seen on television with all the retractors, you know, and everything is in its own spline and it does not carry over on anything else. There's no tangle because your life is on the hook when you're in a situation like that. If you start laying out your hoses in your workplace like this and choose the right length hose for the job, you start to feel like, you know, I not only know how to brew, I'm starting to get really awesome in just the way I conduct myself. And I want other people who work with me to conduct themselves like this. That's called safety culture. That's on the top of the tree. Put stuff when it's not needed, put it away. Okay. For protection, a textured surface. So, you know, a beautiful epoxy surface with no grit in it is pretty slick. So, you know, be careful about that. Keep the drain covers on until you need to get under them, if you need to get under them. Don't just rip them out and forget about them, because then you've just got a twisting of ankle hazard there all the time. And wearing good boots for the job. Electrical hazards here are pretty minor. One safe work practice here, switch off the equipment before plugging it in. Right? You don't want to just, you don't want to start pumping something to the wrong place when you're not there because you're 30 feet away plugging it in. Use proper wiring, grounded circuits. Your fixtures are waterproof and in good condition. Everything's in good repair. We're going to be dealing with some hot water here that's going to happen to have caustic in it. We'll deal with the caustic next. Stand back when filling and recirculating. There's no reason to be there right where everything's splashing out of the sample valve. Disconnect tri-clamps carefully. CIP arms are famous for holding a standing column of solution that, you know, if you can figure out a clever way to get that out without getting it on you by using a valve on your CIP device, for example, you can drain it all back and it'd be enclosed. So think about those things. Safe work practice stuff. For protection, you want to have thermostatic temperature control so you don't overheat your caustic water. And then long pants, a long sleeve shirt, rubber boots, rubber gloves, and eye protection. And the eye protection here for hot solutions is basically to keep it out of the eyes being the most tender of all of your dermal contact opportunities. And, you know, if you guys are still wearing shorts, I don't mean to sound harsh, but get over it, okay? Get out of the shorts. Every other industry where there's these kind of hazards exist, shorts would be abominably ridiculous. And how you get away with it and how you choose to do it, it mystifies me, okay? So please graduate from the shorts. Get a pair of proper long pants and wear those when you're doing this. Talk to your mates. There are too many people who've been seriously scalded because of the choice of their pants. And next, we're going to get on to the concentrated caustic. This is the stuff in the barrel that's, really super gnarly. I want to read and understand the SDS. That used to be called the MSDS, Material Safety Data Sheet. We now call them the Safety Data Sheet. I'm going to observe the labels on the container, and I'm going to observe the placards in the vicinity of the storage area. Placards are usually things that are on a wall. Now, did you notice any placards on the wall where you saw those drums, those of you with photographic memory? There wasn't one, okay? So we're going to come back to that. You'd be trained in chemical handling, right? You didn't figure this one out for yourself. You figured out how to do it safely. Somebody showed you. You've got good housekeeping in the area of chemicals so that you're not in a pile of clutter. You've got whenever affected surfaces might have caught a splash or a drip, you've washed it off as soon as you had a chance so that somebody else doesn't come in and encounter that. And you've dispensed it where others won't be affected. So those are really cool safe work practices and admin controls you can use there. Then you want to use a non-reactive pump, and again, all this wonderful PPE, except now we want to have goggles on the face, and on top of the goggles, a flip-down face shield. Both. Because if you turn your attention away from what you're doing here at the moment of the splash, you can get hit, and you've still got to have that protection for the eyes. This has happened. And now dilute caustic, it's mostly the same, except we can go without the face shield now and just get down to some splash protection for the eyes. Okay, so we've got our 8 steps of our task, and we know what kind of solutions in terms of prevention and protection we want to apply to each of those. Now I'm going to show you photographs of the job being done with these things in consideration. And then I'll identify for you at each step what hazards, just as a reminder, what hazards are we talking about here? We're connecting the CIP to the vessel. We've got to power it up. And over here in the far corner, you'll see the power cord that goes off somewhere else. And we've organized the hoses in such a nice way that we still have an aisle space here. And the drains still have their covers on. Those are the major hazards right there. And what did that cost us? Nothing. Did it even take any extra time? No. We're going to fill the CIP tanks. Now we've got to get that concentrated caustic. Notice the guy here. He's got goggles on. He's got face eye protection with side shields is the best he had. He's got a flip-down face mask. He's got a rubberized apron, long-sleeve shirt and pants, nitrile gloves for the hardcore stuff, and he's pumping in a nice way. And look what's on the back wall there. Now there's a placard. Okay, and then he's very cautiously dumping that into the hot water. He's observed the SDS, and he's also minding himself around the hot water, and slips and trips still exist, so he's cautious about those. Just here's the before and after of the chemical storage area. It's a lot of clutter that was piled up on top of the nitric acid drum. There were acids stored with the bases, and that sort of defeats the whole purpose of segregation. So in the picture on the right, the acids are with the acids, the bases are with the bases. Everybody's got what we call an NFPA placard on the wall that shows the hazards for that particular storage area, and the housekeeping is improved to the right of things. Okay, that took somebody 5 minutes to do, and it's a good fix. It's not just for this job. It's setting it up for the next job to be done right, too. So that was a good investment in time. Hazard assessment results in those kind of improvements all the time. Okay, then jobs 3 and 4, we're loading the caustic and we're circulating it. And now we've got dilute caustics, we've got slips and trips still happening. We've still got the chance of encountering hot water. It's difficult to see here, but you guys know how this goes. There's, if I can find my arrow, get back here. You know, there's caustic that's spilling out around here because the manway's intentionally not clamped super snug, and there's some caustic dripping out of this valve right here. You have to have some place for the liquid you pump into the vessel to go, and you can't be pumping it into an entirely closed tank. And then, see, draining the caustic here, he was able to uncouple the caustic at this point. Back. Uncouple the caustic. Right there, you can see where the pump head is and put it directly into the floor drain. And then as soon as he gets a minute, he's hosed off. See the red hose in the distance? Be careful, the floor is wet, sandwich sign. And he's using water to rinse off everything into the floor drain. And then I won't do the whole thing for the rinse, but it's the same process repeated and drain everything out. And then at the end of the task, something that we didn't think of in the beginning, but now we can go back and put step 9 in our SOP, because it occurred to us while we were thinking about safety that washing the chemical beaker and washing the PPE off is also very important. And so this little wrap-up task we'll call step 9, and that includes taking good care of the PPE. PPE often gets contaminated just in our use, right? You flip it up, you've got caustic on your gloves, and then you wonder why the next time you pick up that face mask, it's all chalky. That's not chalk. Yo, it's caustic soda. So wash it off right then. Isn't that beautiful? Okay? That's the way I want you to take any particular task in the brewery and break it down first operationally. What are each of the steps in the job? And then use that diamond placard you can download after the conference. Go through and say, this is the hazard, this is the hazard, this is the hazard, and here are my solutions, whether prevention or protection or a combination of both, to deal with that. Okay. Once again, last slide, outline the task and steps, find the hazards for each step, find the hazard control strategy, protection and prevention, PPE, administrative controls, all that stuff for each hazard. Then do the work safely. It will feel good. It's like a vitamin for your soul to be safe. Trust me on this. Engage each other, your coworkers, your staff, and document your choices. You've gone all this thought process into it. Write it down as you're thinking about it, and you've got a glorious SOP where maybe you didn't have one before. So you're killing two great birds with one stone. You're increasing the quality of your process and your brewing, and you're increasing your safety and well-being. And just keep expanding that and move through. And you know what? You're not doing it for the four-letter word guys. You're doing it for yourselves. And in the process of building a safe workplace like this, you will be able to check off a lot of boxes for the four-letter word guys. The big one that they're going to look at right away as soon as they show up is, what do you have for documentation? Well, we've done a hazard analysis for these tasks, and we've come up with SOPs, and here's how we handle all those things. And yes, here's our SDSs, and here are our training records, and here's our written program for confined spaces that we don't enter, and all that good stuff. Okay? Questions? Now is a good time. How did I do for time, Damon? Good. Okay. If you're shy and you want to talk about something bad that happened, that's okay. I will keep a confidence. You can talk to me afterwards. My contact info is right here for you. I'm Matt, the safety ambassador, or as we like to say, the safety ambassador for the Brewers Association. And I want you to engage with each other and engage with your colleagues at the BA on safety. Because I will tell you, if the Chinese proverb is true, the fish rots from the head, the BA has a top-down, non-rotten safety philosophy that comes from the board of directors and people like Paul Gatza, right on down through all of the technical committees. We're working with all of the safety guys, are working with all of the other subcommittees. There's a lot of crosstalk, a lot of development going on. And if you have a need in safety and you let us know what it is, we will provide it for you. We're on it, okay? So don't be shy. Got to talk about safety. It's easier than talking about safe sex. Thank you very much. Okay, we got a question.
Hello. Good talk, by the way. Great
talk. Thank
you very much. Quick question, just kind of more specifically on confined space. We don't get in our fermenters at all. We just get in the mash tun, kind of final cleanup, and then in the kettle, because we kind of have a spray shadow behind our calandria. Getting there, hose it out and everything, and we've kind of been talking about what we kind of need to do for that. Is that qualify as confined space because it's... Is that an oxygen-deficient atmosphere? Because there's no CO2 present. We have a stack fan, and everything's open. We lock out, tag out the mash rakes, that kind of thing.
Good question. Here's where you go. There are confined spaces, meaning it's difficult to get in and out of. It's not designed for continuous human occupancy, and it can have some inherent hazards for you while you're in there. And maybe atmospheric, it may be sloping bottoms, it could be a lot of different things. In a brewery, you're generally going to fall into two categories of confined space. Confined spaces that can be classified, we call it reclassification, as a space you can enter as a non-permit space, vis-a-vis the vessels in a brew house where there's no CO2 atmosphere problem. And the other thing is, you have to be able to control all of the hazards that could be in that space from without of the space, from outside the space. So you lock out your mash rakes, you close the valves for your CIP inlets, and you wrap a chain around them or you put a valve lock on them. Those things, it's a small investment, and you just work it into your daily process, and you'll find it doesn't take more than a minute to do those things. If you control all of the hazards from outside the space and it does not involve an atmospheric hazard, you may get into it. Mm-hmm. And you may even do so alone, although, of course, I wouldn't recommend that. You've got to have somebody nearby. But again, lockout, tagout on all possible things. You can go into those. If you follow this process here, these are the steps for deep clean on the mash tun. And you break it all down like that. Look for where the hazards are. Give an operation solution to each hazard. The steam could come on. Some cockamamie person could show up. I don't know they're there. They turn on the steam, and I start to get very hot in here. Okay, so that's no good. It has to be controlled. So the steam valve goes off, or the boiler goes off. The steam valve is locked out. Wrap a chain around it. There's something you can do. If you do all of those things and do this hazard assessment process, you'll have a fundamental procedure for safe entry into that space. Now, fermenters with the atmospheric problem, just don't be going in there. Use CIP. Don't stick your head in a fermenter. Any part of the body that goes through the fermenter, and I realize we reach in to retrieve the door. Technically, any part of your body passes the plane of a confined space, you've entered it. But in the case of a fermenter, it's really an atmospheric problem. Don't be going in there, sticking your head in it. Take off spray. You want removable spray balls. If you're just engineering your brewery now, get spray balls you can take out from the outside of the tank so that they just go on with a tri-clamp so that you don't have to climb in on a step ladder to unscrew the ball. That's a problem for some people.
Okay.
Good.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. My question is, how do you get even the last guy to apply as simple as safety goggles? So I worked at multiple places, and even if they had caustic in their eyes and had to attend at a hospital, they still don't wear it. So, and I mean, you can do a ton of things. You can say it. You can show them this very heavy pictures with worst case scenario,
yeah,
where they had to extract the eye, right?
I'm going to give you the hardcore answer.
And they still don't do it. So, I mean, you know, you can give them a warning or whatever, or you just get fire them. I mean, but is that really the
I know, we're all short of help, so who wants to fire somebody? I understand that. What you do is you make it very plain and simple. Doing the job in the correct fashion, and I'm telling you the correct fashion right now. Here's how, follow this procedure. Doing the job in the correct fashion is a condition of employment.
All right.
If you are not doing it by the correct method, you are not working here.
Simple as it is.
Simple as that. You got to put your money where your mouth is. And at that point, somebody said, you know, I find this workplace hostile. I'm going to quit. Okay, goodbye, fairy boy, because you can't do it right and do it safely. So that's, I know that sounds hardcore.
Yeah.
But you know what? And the next person you hire comes in there, and the people that they're working with who've been there say, you should have seen what happened to the last guy. That guy steps in line. And that's how you build safety culture. In a business where safety culture is adverse. So I will tell you right now, having consulted for some pretty large breweries, large in the craft sense, national craft brands, even with a lot of resources thrown at it, it's 2 to 3 to 4 years to turn that attitude around. But you have to start.
All right.
And the other thing is, ownership has to show complete belief and operation in safety. They have to, if this is a safety glasses area, the owner is not immune. The owner walks through, they've got safety glasses. If they don't, you go, hey boss, here's a pair right here. Just like that. You make it the conversation. If you bring the conversation. So I know we're all gonna have to deal with people who are recalcitrant at some times, but it's a condition of employment. And I mean, if I was gonna talk about the federal government, I would say there's even a regulation in what we call the general duty clause that says the employer has the responsibility to create a safe and healthful workplace, subparagraph A. Subparagraph B says the employee will do what is necessary and according to their training and equipment to be safe. It's not just the employer. It's also the employee. And we need to point that out to some employees.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That was a great question. It's a hard thing to tackle.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Yes, sir.
Nice talk, Matt. One thing that you kind of mentioned real quickly is we struggle with, we have 60-barrel, 90-barrel type of premier tanks. With dry hopping and tanks kind of spread out all over Kingdom Come and different ceiling dimensions, have you found a really good system for getting employees secure? We've had some quotes, and it's not the cheapest.
It's not cheap. Like I say, I put administrative controls and safe work practices up for craft brewers above engineering controls, because some of these engineering controls are pricey. and you didn't you didn't expect that kind of dollar expense. Catwalk is the best answer. Catwalk with railings where you can reach everything from the catwalk. And, you know, with varying height tanks and spread all over, that's a lot of iron. In the absence of that, a securitized way of putting a person on a man lift can work. You know, whether it's a genie lift, so to speak, or a scissor lift, depending on where you can get in there. There is a device that can be, a certified device that can be put on a forklift, that's a cage that's secured to the forklift blades, and then your person is attached to the anchor point on that cage. That's another way. That's a two-person operation, obviously. Somebody's operating the forklift. Forklifts really aren't made for moving people around. You know, you can squeeze somebody's head into a ceiling if you're not careful. And then, you know, there are rolling ladders, rolling ladder platforms, but you've got to chalk those or lock the wheels. Buddy system with a portable ladder, and the portable ladder is attached to a fixed point on the tank, an anchoring point there, and then as soon as the individual gets up, they're going to clip into an anchoring system that you've devised. If you're going to get into that, the best thing to do is find a consultant who knows that kind of safety rigging work, and there will be a cheaper solution than a catwalk, but it's still going to cost you some money. The other thing with dry hopping, folks, if you're doing it, is, you know, you get a gush of CO2s coming out of the port if you're, say, taking off the spray ball or the pressure relief valve to dry hop. You're getting a blast of CO2 up there. That can cause enough wobbliness for the individual on top of the ladder to faint and to fall right off the ladder. So having them fully secured is really the best way. Or, you know, a device for delivering hops that can be done from the ground story. We were talking about that before the talk today. There are a lot of vendors here this year that are making all sorts of their versions of the better known German hop delivery systems, and they're not all necessarily pressure tested and legitimized. So I'd say buyer beware on those as well. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks.
Good. We want hops in the beer, lots of hops, but be careful dry hopping. Okay, well, if there are no more questions, really happy to have you. Thank you for showing up today.